Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm Nick Kovac, guest hosting. I'm here with Professor Thomas Rowland. We are marching. We're going to get to Georgia eventually. We're at the battle hymn stage, and we haven't quite gotten to the war itself. But the theme of today's show on the Maggie Dawn Show is the political divisiveness, the ad hominem attacks, the insults, the threatened, the implied, the actual political violence that is going on in 2024 and obviously happened also on January 6, 2021, most famously, is it unprecedented in American history? And I think we've come to the conclusion that in most people's lifetimes, it's unprecedented, but certainly not in American history, certainly not in the long 19th century. And we were in the mid-1850s. The Republican Party had just been born in good old Wisconsin. And what did that party do with itself?
Well, I'll get to that very shortly.
Yeah.
But to pick up with the kind of the catalog of the 1850s, yes, and basically picking up with the Republicans in 1856, just 2 years after the genesis, they were able to go into convention at Pittsburgh and they nominated their first presidential candidate. That was John C. Fremont, the old Pathfinder, the explorer. And he was, you know, leaning towards abolition even at that point.
Future insubordinate general on the issue of abolition. He got there before Lincoln did.
Yeah, right. And as you might expect, as a, you know, he ran against James Buchanan, who had been mostly in Europe, so he was not scarred by all of the poor Democratic policies that were enacted, such as the Kansas-Nebraska Act. So Fremont didn't do too well, although he did capture Wisconsin and a number of far northern tier states. Mm-hmm. But, you know, remember, southern states were voting in 1856, as they would in 1860. And, you know, the combination was too much for any hope. So the Democrat Buchanan. But that same year, 1856, talking about the escalation where this thing became hot, it's 1856 when Lawrence is sacked in Kansas. It's 1856 when John Brown goes crazy along Pottawatomie Creek. But it also is reflected politically in the climate in Washington, D.C., where there are outright, I mean, I don't know whether people know of these things, but some of them are crazy. One may have ended up somewhat humorously, but just as a quick example, in 1856, 1860, John Fox Potter, who was the first congressional district in Wisconsin, a Republican and an abolitionist, had words, shall we say, with Roger Pryor, who was a congressman from Virginia, one of those old-time cavalier, chivalrous people. And the escalation in the argument got to the point where Pryor simply said, "I challenge you to a duel." Well, the concept of dueling, especially in the North, but even in the South, but especially in the North, it was a ludicrous thing. And
by that time, it was pretty standard 50 years prior, right?
Yeah, certainly in the early Republic, you'd still see it. I mean, Aaron Burr in 1804 killed Hamilton in
New Jersey. And led to a great Broadway show.
Yeah, it sure did, didn't it? But in any event, one of the, you know, it got, you know, since it was ludicrous, Potter decided to make fun of it. And he essentially told Pryor, well, you challenge, I get to choose the weapons and the place, because that was the custom.
Yeah.
And basically Potter said, I choose Bowie knives, you know, dueling, you know, maybe by sword or by pistol, but he did that. And even though this isn't verified, he suggested it be done in a broom closet. So, I mean, and so Pryor just walked away and the thing fizzled.
It's, a lot of fights, the best way to end them is a good joke.
Yeah, no, exactly. And Potter continued. He lived a long life. He died in 1899 in his East Troy home, which is where he was from. Coming down from the landing on the second floor, he tried to avoid his cat, who was perched on one of the steps.
Mm.
He took a major tumble.
The man who survived...
That nearly took me out once.
What's that?
I had a major fall trying to avoid my cat on the stairs.
Oh, there you go. Now, not to, you know, I'm allergic to cats, and so I have a different view, and, you know, I don't want a rush of PETA calls to come in here, but my thinking is a cat?
You mean a man that survived a congressional knife fight in a broom closet can't survive a house cat?
No, I know. Well,
he walked from the fight. He didn't walk away from the cat successfully.
Right. Yeah. My thought was, well, a dog, yeah, but a cat?
What? He should have picked a cat as a weapon for the duel. I'll bring my cat, you bring yours.
Yeah, no, well, I don't know whether Pryor owned any cats. He probably owned a lot of thoroughbred horses, but in any event. Another one, Wisconsin connection, Senator Dodge,
mm-hmm.
Was one of our first senators. Now, he was a Democrat,
mm-hmm.
But things were getting so messy in the halls of Congress, Senate and representatives, that people were carrying in pistols,
mm-hmm.
and some of them, like Dodge, brandished them. Now, they didn't fire, but... You know, there's this intensity in the political climate that, you know, has to be recognized. There's two more that I'll just real quickly go over. Congressman Barksdale from Mississippi, sort of had like a wrestling match with Elihu Washburn, a congressman from Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And during this tussle, Washburn swiped at... Barksdale's head, and in the process knocked off his wig.
Mm.
And someone in the crowd yelled, he's taken a scalp.
Yeah.
And actually that diffused the whole thing. Everyone on both sides just had a good laugh, mm-hmm. and that diffused it. But one incident...
There's one that's not very funny at all. I know the one you're getting to.
Yeah, the caning of Senator Sumner.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that was in 1856. Sumner gave a speech in which he, it was called entitled The Crimes in Kansas or Against Kansas. And in it, he did mock an aging senator by the name of Andrew Butler of South Carolina. And it was a little vicious.
Well, he basically implied that there were, I think, sexual relations between him and people he had enslaved, which was a common practice at the time. So it wasn't slander, but it was nasty.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in it, he said, he referred to this gentleman from the South and blah, blah, blah. And he said at one point, whose mistress is a whore,
mm-hmm.
and that mistress was slavery. So there was clearly
It was a double entendre.
Yeah.
He was talking about the concept of slavery that he was...
Right. And Butler had also had a mild stroke that affected his speech. In fact, he wasn't even in the Senate on that occasion. And Sumner went out of his way to say who expectorates... vile things or whatever.
Oh, so he might have mocked a speech impediment, too.
Right, exactly. Well, which was caused by a mild stroke.
Mm-hmm.
His Butler's nephew, a man by the name of Preston Brooks, was in the South Carolina House of Representatives in D.C. And he heard it, and he made the decision that he wasn't going to challenge Sumner to a duel. He wasn't going, to upbraid him just vocally. He would treat him as he would a cur, a mangy dog. And he strode into the Senate while Sumner was at his desk, and he had a colleague hold off others with a pistol and knocked Sumner over the head repeatedly to within an inch of his life.
And it was one of those desks were tight, so he's basically his knees were sort of stuck under his own desk. He couldn't escape.
Exactly. He couldn't. Right. And it was so bad that, Sumner had to take leave from the Senate and seek a cure in England, and so was out of the Senate for 4 years, I think. I don't know, somewhere in there. But in any event, I think that and what was going on in Kansas made 1856 and everything after it reach this climax that was war. If you would, you know, you have the Dred Scott decision.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go over that, but hopefully if people are interested, they can read about it. But that was a clear signal. But what was important about that?
Supreme Court decision. Yeah.
Yes. Roger B. Taney,
mm-hmm.
A Democrat from Maryland, was Chief Justice, and he declared, you know, basically he revokes the Missouri Compromise by saying that Dred Scott, a slave in Missouri, his owner took him to Minnesota. And, you know, Dred Scott's lawyers were arguing once Dred Scott was brought into a northern state that that ended his term as a slave.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Taney said, no, slaves are defined as chattel, mm-hmm. and they are property. And
he literally denied the humanity of black people.
Exactly.
In a Supreme Court decision.
Right. And so that just added fuel to the fire. And this stuff goes on, and I'll just come up to the final
mm-hmm.
one, and then, you know, might even get into the war itself and the election of 1864.
Yeah.
But if you would, you know, John Brown's raid in at Harper's Ferry, you know, was a signal to the South that this was, you know, this was, in a sense, the point of no return. Mm-hmm. And looming, because that happened in October, you know, John Brown was hung in early December 1859.
Yeah.
The next year is an election year, and I'll, you know, move towards that. And, you know, but very simply, the election of 1860 was a clarion call for Southerners. The election of the Republican, the Black Republican, mm-hmm. as they called him, would be the signal for departing the Union.
Yes.
And of course, in the election, the Democrats shot themselves in the foot. They couldn't agree between Northern Democrats and Southern Democrats. Southern Democrats did not like Douglas because all of the problems created by his popular sovereignty status.
We'll come back to the other candidates in 1860, and we'll talk about the war that resulted from an election. Maggie Dawn Show is back. I'm Nick Kovac, and you're listening to me talk to Professor Thomas Rowland. We just got to the 1860 election. Lincoln was nominated. I mean, we could spend an hour talking about why Lincoln was nominated. It was a famous convention in Chicago's. He was not. He was very much a dark horse candidate, much like Garfield 20 years later, also a Chicago convention. And although, unlike Garfield, who maybe truly did just back into it, Lincoln was plotting for it. Had an organized plan. And basically Seward, and was it Chase?
There
was
Sam and Chase.
Yeah, were the contenders. And kind of like Russ Feingold, the third guy kind of emerged because no one could agree on the top two guys. Yeah. I don't know if that, is that, maybe that's not a fair summary. I don't know.
Well, it's close enough.
Close enough for government work. Anyway, Lincoln's the Republican candidate, which will have huge consequences, which we'll probably get into in a minute. And then the Democrats are split. Well, there was a fourth candidate too, wasn't there?
Yeah, John Bell, the from Tennessee, mm-hmm. who was the Union constitutional candidate,
mm-hmm.
and it was, you know, typical of the Upper South. You know, they didn't really want to instigate secession,
mm-hmm.
But they wanted a reconciliation,
yes.
within the Union. His candidacy is somewhat insignificant. The okay. big thing is the mm-hmm. Democrats.
Right. They were split.
Yeah. They met in South Carolina, Charleston, and they broke up because Southern Democrats could not stomach the idea of nominating Stephen Douglas for all of his faults and equivocating on the slavery issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, They proceeded, Southern Democrats proceeded to nominate John C. Breckinridge from Kentucky, but a slaver and strong Southern Democrat.
Douglas was maybe the Nikki Haley. He was like someone who ultimately would capitulate to the interests of the hardcore, but wavered just enough that the hardcore didn't trust him.
Yeah. I don't know whether in their minds they had visions of Nikki Haley in their head. But yet, yeah, yes. But you're right.
I'm just making an analogy.
Yeah, no. I think it's fair to say that. Douglas is nominated as a Democratic candidate. Basically a northern one. The election, because the Democrats couldn't pull it together, Lincoln wins the election. Douglas does poorly. Breckinridge takes care of most of the South.
Yeah.
And I think Bell, I think he got Tennessee, but mm-hmm. not much else. Lincoln won it with a 39% plurality mm-hmm. in the popular vote. So he's a minority president. But enough that he has, enough electoral votes, he's the president. Well, that's a bellwether. That's a sign for the South to secede. And within just a few weeks, South Carolina leads the charge into secession, joined by six more states in the Deep South. And four who are holding out to see in early 1861 mm-hmm. whether this thing can get resolved as to which way they would go.
And there was a compromise on the table at the Crittenden Compromise, right, which was going to further entrench slavery.
Right.
In the North, even. It was going to sort of commit the North to.
Yeah. So the Crittenden Compromise didn't have a chance of flying off the shelf mm-hmm. at all. And once Fort Sumter was fired upon, those four, fence sitting states, Virginia, Arkansas, Tennessee, and another one I can't recall right now, mm-hmm. They join, the Confederacy.
But there's still four states where slavery is legal that don't join the Confederacy, right? Missouri, Kentucky,
Maryland
and Delaware.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or did Delaware join?
No, Virginia.
No, Virginia joined the Confederacy.
Not immediately.
Oh, not immediately. But there were four that never joined it, I think, right? Missouri.
Well, oh, yes, right. You're dealing with them. Missouri, Maryland, and Kentucky.
Just those three?
Three.
Okay.
Yeah. So in any event, they did, they secede, they join the secession. And so now, in response to Fort Sumter's firing, Lincoln calls for 75,000 volunteers from the North, and we're on the brink of civil war. Of course, it was very unrealistic. They called for 3-month volunteers, which was one of the reasons why there was an impulsive march on the Confederacy at Manassas mm-hmm. Bull Run. But in any event, we're now into war.
Mm-hmm.
If I have your leave, I want to, advance mostly the political climate between 1861 leading up to the election of 1864.
Please do. I think we have 3 minutes before the next break and we'll pick up after that.
Okay, great. Well, in 1861, with the war on, I mentioned those 75,000 volunteers. Well, a lot of them came from places like Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, and other places. But I'm looking at those, and that is they responded to the call, and they, get together, and they travel south by train.
Mm-hmm.
It's an oddity of Baltimore at the time that there was no connection. Once you hit the north side of Baltimore, you had to detrain. You had to go off. You had to go through the city.
Mm-hmm.
As soldiers, they had to march through the city.
And I think that's the journey Frederick Douglass took in the other direction, right? Trying to escape.
Oh, Yeah.
Or I know he had to take a ferry across some river separating Maryland from Delaware, maybe, or Pennsylvania.
Yeah. But I don't know whether, you know, he did work before he left. He worked as a sort of a deckhand on a ship.
Right. And then he had someone else's sailor papers.
Yeah.
And he started out on a train. And,
yeah. Well, in any event, these troops had to march through Baltimore to the south side where the train line mm-hmm. linked back up to Washington. Mm-hmm. It's Camden Yards, and of course we know that is the baseball stadium yes. for the Baltimore Orioles. Mm-hmm. But in any event, as they marched through, these troops were assaulted by those people of Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Maryland is a very funny place. Mm-hmm. The South Shore, the Eastern Shore, and the city of Baltimore were very Southern, both in politics but in culture, mm-hmm. and very much pro-secession. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they mangled these troops, and the troops fired in the crowd. I don't know the ultimate number of casualties, but it was very alarming. And, you know, to Lincoln, Maryland was the most important state to keep in the Union. Mm-hmm. We know Washington is separated from Virginia to the south, basically, yeah. by the Potomac River. But Maryland surrounds on three sides.
It would have been like Berlin.
Yeah. No, it was a very good analogy. It was necessary to keep them in the fold and to squash secessionist sentiment.
Well, we've made it all the way to 1861. We'll pick up there as we take our journey to 1864 with its lessons for 2024. You're listening to The Maggie Don Show.
Good old bugle boys, we'll sing another song. Sing it with the spirit that will start the world.
Welcome back to the Maggie Don Show. It took us an hour and a half, but the war is on. The Civil War. We're in 1861 in the riots of the Confederate sympathizing but still Unionist state of Maryland against the, well, they wouldn't be invading. They were just a logistical tale of a hope to be invading force coming through Maryland. And Lincoln, he was worried about Missouri. He was worried about Kentucky. It's an interesting counterfactual. If he had lost those states, would the secession have succeeded? Arguably, if Maryland had seceded, well, if nothing else, it would have put Lincoln's home and the seat of government in a real pickle. And would the war have been over before it started, and would secession have succeeded if Maryland had?
Good question. You know, I think it would have, I don't know, it would have maybe caused the evacuation of D.C.
And probably go back to New York or Philadelphia,
yeah,
for a capital.
Exactly, yeah. That or, you know, close the tomb and withdraw, you mm-hmm. know. So it could have, a lot of things might have been. Mm-hmm. But I'll pick up with that.
Yeah.
Again, I kind of describe what happened and the importance of Maryland mm-hmm. to the Northern government. And Lincoln acted, you know, using emergency powers. Mm-hmm. This was a national crisis, and he was willing to, in an emergency, basically step above what had been long treasured constitutional rights.
Because did he start imprisoning Maryland House of Representatives who were Confederate sympathizers?
Yes. And in fact, anyone who was in some form of opposition, there was a rash of arbitrary arrests based on the suspension of habeas corpus. You didn't need, you know, due cause.
And even though I think it's safe to say that you and I, and I think most of our listeners, if not all of them, are rooting for Lincoln at this point, the techniques Lincoln used were quite authoritarian. And I think a lot of people are worried, you know, if Trump wins, what if he were to use Lincoln's precedent in Maryland and start arresting local officials who don't do what he wants?
Yeah, well, it's sort of definitely hinted in Project 2025.
Yes.
Yeah, so, yeah, I would be a little alarmed, you know, except for my my receiving Medicare and supplemental insurance, and which I don't have to pay for, and Social Security, mm-hmm. I would... I'd frankly move to Canada. I have some good friends there. So, mm-hmm. but, you know, I'm not, you know, but I do, you know, have a reasonable fear of a Trump election.
Yeah.
Boy, I knew you would get me into the modern age.
Yes.
I like to linger in the past.
Yes.
But if you would, you know, so he does these things. Suspension of habeas corpus, arbitrary arrests. In the late fall, there was a convention called in for the state of Maryland out in Frederick, mm-hmm. which is in the western section of Maryland, and it was considered to be the secessionist convention. Mm-hmm. And somewhat ironically, George McClellan was the commander, mm-hmm. and Lincoln ordered him to send troops to Frederick to close down that convention, not let it be held. So, you know, he's taking these drastic actions.
And this was
actions.
Used against him in 1864 at the Democratic Convention.
Yeah, it's sort of used even against him before because, you know, one of the sort of intriguing things, Roger B. Taney is still around. He's still the Chief Justice. And he declared all of these actions as illegal and unconstitutional. Lincoln simply ignores
them. He didn't go so far as Andrew Jackson and to have a pithy line about ignoring them, right? Didn't Andrew Jackson say the Supreme Court has made their law, now let them enforce it?
Yeah.
Lincoln
yeah.
just quietly ignored it?
Yeah. He just, yeah. I mean, he had bigger fish to fry, you know, than listen to Taney. So in any event, you have that. Now, as a result of that, it does start in 1861. Democrats of the North, and especially those who believe their civil liberties are being, you know, forfeited, embrace an emblem on a copper coin where you have Lady Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of embrace that, you know, this fight for liberty as their, you know, their slogan. And it took a little while, but it's one of those things that backfires on you because as the war intensifies and as this crisis leading to 1864, Republicans dubbed them as copperheads.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the slimy snake that, not so slimy, but a snake,
yeah.
a small snake that's enormously poisonous and who likes to strike you from behind.
Oh,
and undercut you. So the idea of that, and I won't,
sounds more dangerous than a house cat.
Yes, definitely.
Maybe a little.
I didn't want to, you know, I'll be real quick. You know, when I lived in D.C. for a long time, I like to go out to the, towards the the Blue Ridge Mountains. There was a single mountain there called Old Rag, and you'd have to walk a switchback that was basically trees and shrubs and whatever, but as on one occasion I stepped on a nest of copperheads, and I was awfully happy that mama wasn't nearby because mm-hmm. I would have gotten, you know, bitten.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, you know, this is, you know, see, this is a slogan turned
on the
Democrats.
That's a good metaphor for your historic career, that you step on the baby copperheads. Extinguish their
yeah, I know
their
yeah.
lionization. That
yeah,
end
I didn't
the
go,
lost cause.
I'm afraid I didn't go back to see if I hurt the babies. So you know, but in any event, you know, again, you know, this idea there, and basically by late 1862 into 1863, you have, and somewhat ironically, since it's George McClellan's victory at Antietam that permits Lincoln, you know, on a high note, because the battles before this were pretty miserable, it gives him the ability to issue the Emancipation yes. Proclamation to go into effect.
Antietam was the key pivot in the war for not for the, for the war itself, but more importantly, for the expansion of the war aims from merely union to emancipation.
Precisely. Yes. Now, of course, Democrats are appalled by this. And actually, George McClellan, at one point, since we're kind of talking a little bit about him, he said something to the effect that if there are, in fact, any mistakes, any wrong policies referring to the Emancipation Proclamation, the voters will have to correct that in the fall of 1862.
So he essentially endorses against his boss while it's still his boss.
Yes, but he...
or implied endorsement.
Yes, it'll only be another month after the elections, which the Democrats did a little bit better. But after the elections, McClellan was disposable.
And then he went and hung out with his cushy Democratic backers in Manhattan at an apartment he wasn't paying for, I believe, right?
Oh, no. Yeah, he was well-funded by outside sources.
Quite a few parallels to
that.
Clarence Thomas, are you listening?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I kind of like this show if this is where we're going. But to get back to him, very simply, this kind of leads us eventually to, you know, this major wrinkle, the Emancipation Proclamation, and now the campaign of 1864, which we have a little bit addressed, but very simply, the Republicans now choose the moniker, the Union Party.
Yes.
And they, Lincoln ditches his first term vice president, Hannibal Hamlin, in favor of the only remaining Democratic senator from the South, Tennessee, Andrew Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, that one didn't work out well, but...
although arguably the backlash against Johnson might not have been as, you know, as bad as Johnson was, 1868 to 1876 might not have been as good without Johnson's counterexample. But that's a weird counterfactual to present.
Yeah, I think we can can discuss that over a draft at Black Husky.
Yes.
How's that sound?
Uh-huh.
Okay. You know, so very simply, the Republicans, the summer of 1864, the war is now entering into its fourth year. It's going miserably. There seems to be no light at the end of the tunnel. Sherman is slowly pushing his way down toward Atlanta, but not there.
Mm-hmm.
And Grant is on the overland campaign and, you know, is racking up what's called the butcher's bill because he's throwing these troops in and, you know, before he gets to the outside of Richmond, 50,000 Union troops have been killed.
Mm-hmm.
And Lincoln himself is very distressed in August of 1864. He confided to, you know, one of his secretaries, I expect to be beaten in the fall and beaten badly.
Yep. If there had been, well, that you had, Keith Olbermann referenced this, right?
Yeah. We talked off air on this one. You know, today when I was getting ready to come out, I just squandered a little bit on cable TV and came across Keith Olbermann's, I think it's called Countdown, is his cable show. And the first thing that they dealt with was Trump crashing in the polls.
Mm-hmm.
And Olbermann went, well, you know, this has happened before. And he alluded to several, but the last one he alluded to, and he said, basically, if Lincoln, if there had been any kind of polls in 1864, in August of 1864, Lincoln's polls would be crashing.
And what's remarkable about this is the South doesn't even get to vote because they've seceded. So Lincoln's going to lose the North.
Yeah, no, I know, exactly. And that's another dimension to the election that I think needs to be noted. But if you would, he's very depressed. In fact, he writes out a memo or a little letter, announces it to some of his cabinet members, and then he rolls it up and puts it in his roll-top desk, in which he basically is conceding he will lose, and it's an effort to cooperate with the newly elected president to at least in the transition see this thing to a successful conclusion, the war effort.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, he never had to bring that out. But if you would, On the other side, the Democrats, and I think I referred to this already, they're going to shoot themselves in the foot like they did in 1860. And that is the dominant faction at the convention in Chicago is Copperhead, mm-hmm. is Peace Democrats.
These little baby snakes.
God.
Yeah. No, they're human beings. We just call them.
Yeah. No, there's some, you know, I love politics of this era. You know, I always say, if you think our politics are kind of divisive, it's marshmallows and pussy willows compared to the mid-19th century.
Yeah.
The Democrats, the Peace Party writes the convention. And it's very clear from that at any cost, peace. Mm-hmm. And very much implied is, you know, basically, if necessary, Southerners, we wish you all the best. Go peacefully, our brethren. Okay. Mm-hmm. But they need to choose a candidate who has some kind of stature.
Mm-hmm.
And McClellan is that. But McClellan represents the war Democrats who can't turn their backs on.
Who are still pro-union. They're pro-slavery, but they're also pro-union.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Anti-secession, for sure.
And very simply, you know, although it wasn't articulated totally, he basically, he rejects the convention's platform and basically, you know, says that we must win this war. See it to conclusion.
Unlike Trump, he didn't have the luxury of just writing the platform, rewriting it however he saw fit, but he did his own thing. We've come up, we'll finish with, we have one more segment. We'll finish with the election, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about your book. I do want to in the last segment.
Okay.
You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show.
Sang the chorus from Atlanta to the sea. While we were marching, while we were marching, while we were marching through Georgia.
This land is your land.
This land is your land. This land is my land. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. I'm Nick Kovac, guest hosting. We're about to wrap up. We have a few minutes left. Talk about Atlanta, Sherman, and how that helped Lincoln win 1864.
Yes, the despair and, anguish that Lincoln had in August, mid-August of 1864, is ultimately dissipated. And it ultimately turns the election in his favor. On September 2nd, Sherman's army marches into Atlanta, and he sends out a cable telegraph saying Atlanta has been won fairly. That changes the entire dimension of things. Now it looks like there's a trajectory in which success will be achieved, that it will only be a little while longer and it will be wrapped up.
And turnout in Atlanta could be the difference for President Kamala Harris as well.
Okay.
Could be the difference. Now, Mark from Prairie du Sac has a quote about how, let's hear it from Mark, what his quote is.
Yeah, for George Fitch, who was a Confederate thinker, commented that the Revolution of 76, they were repudiating it with the Southern Revolution of 1861. It was a reactionary and conservative rolling back of the excesses of the Reformation, run mad. His solemn protests against the doctrines of natural liberty, human equality, and the social contract, as taught by Locke and the American sages of 1776. An equally solemn protest against the doctrines of Adam Smith and Benjamin Franklin, Jean-Baptiste Say, Tom Paine, and the rest of the infidel political economists who maintain the world is too much governed. And if you read that in conjunction with Project 2025, I hear sorry echoes in Project 2025 of the Confederacy and their rejection of the whole proposition that of the Enlightenment.
Yeah, Mark, I agree with you. I think that's an analogy we actually made off air. I actually asked Professor Rowland, should we make that analogy between the Confederacy and the Trump movement? And, well, I'm glad you went there.
Yes, if I may chime in.
Yeah.
Thank you for that that quote, or, you know, and yes, there is a lot of, you know, connection of the Enlightenment. But I think, you know, your point linking basically the Confederacy and its ultimate aims with today's, you know, Republican.
Well, a lot of Trump rallies literally have Confederate flags. So this isn't even that much of a stretch. There's also flags too, but a lot more Confederate flags.
Well, there were a lot of Confederate flags at the storming of the Capitol on January 6th.
Sure,
hey, that's an interesting quote, and I think I'd like to, you know, sort of bone up on some of that. But I think you make a good comparison in that regard.
And David from San Francisco has a question for Thomas. He's been listening.
Oh, yeah, that previous caller, he raised the unenlightenment. You know, my question is somewhat similar. I was reading a book about the Civil War and the development of it, and apparently the South were convinced by the British. There was apparently a Lord Hazard that sent a letter to the South saying, don't secede. Come up with the company store instead. You can free the slaves, and they'll think they're free, but if they're trapped in the company store where you pay rent to the owner of the factory that you're working for,
basically sharecropping.
That's what it ultimately did happen, was sharecropping. Yeah. But you're right. The English, were very interested in possibly recognizing the Confederacy. And this, you know, at least in Confederate minds, that intervention carried all the way into Gettysburg in 1863, although I think it was most Southerners knew that wasn't going to happen. You know, after the emancipation, after Antietam and the Emancipation Proclamation, England, which had led the world in the abolition of slavery, both, in their entire empire in 1833, there was no way they could take the low road and support a government, a country slavery was such a integral part of. So is that?
Yeah, we could do a whole show on the British and the Confederacy, because on the one hand, the British were anti-slavery. I mean, even during the Revolutionary War, they were willing to free the enslaved persons in order to win that war. But then the power politics, talked about power to start the show. They were worried about the power of the United States, rightly so. They were worried about losing their global dominance, so they were kind of happy from a Henry Kissinger real politics sense to have the North and South split, even though the British had emancipated their own slaves in 1833. And for me, one of the great counterfactuals of the Civil War, and I think one of the myths of the Lost Cause, was slavery on its way to a natural death anyway? I think if it weren't for the U.S. Civil War, probably if that death ever came, it would have been a lot longer.
Yes, it probably, yeah. That, again, it's hard to say exactly, but, it could have been given a new breath of life beyond 1865 had they won, because then the new territories would be up for grabs and they could expand.
Yeah.
Slavery needed to expand.
It was a bit of a pyramid scheme, right?
Yeah, right.
Because really it was the bonds. It was the literal capital or the collateral of the human body that another human owned, which had the value of a car or a house even, and then you would use that as your collateral to expand. But if it ever stopped expanding, it's like a pyramid scheme. You needed new land. You needed new investors, and it didn't. Virginia, the soil, the tobacco, tobacco sent the soil.
Yeah, the Upper South. I mean,
the entire economic system was based on expansion. Having said that, it might have just been less profitable, but it still could have survived. It survived in Virginia long after it was profitable.
Right. And of course, sharecropping became in many respects the new slavery in the post-Civil War.
And the other point I'm really glad that David brought up is that just because slavery ended on paper doesn't mean that effective control of one human being over another didn't still exist for a while and doesn't still exist in 2024. And we should all be very aware of that. We're coming up on time. Professor Roland, thank you so much. This has been a treat. This 2 hours we've spent.
I have enjoyed it enormously, and I really appreciate the invitation to be here.
I hope we get to do it again. That'll be up to Maggie, Dawn, and Jess. Thank you to Jess for being in the booth. Thank you to Maggie for letting us do this and for having this great radio show and radio station across Wisconsin. We didn't get to talk as much as I wanted about your bestseller from 1998 about how George B. McClellan, as bad as he was as a politician, he wasn't quite as bad as general as some people said. And I think there's a lesson in there for how over-lionizing ourselves and over-demonizing our opponents. Having said that, Project 2025 is pretty terrifying and worth demonization. But we should still do it carefully and factually and accurately. Thank you, everyone, for all your time. Thank you to Professor Roland. Tom, it's been a thrill. We'll continue this over a beer at Black Husky.
Indeed.